Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca, of course. And I am delighted to have Jason Miller on the program today. I've known Jason for a while, and he is a committed activist. And he's also the editor of Thomas Paine's Corner. In his words, it's dedicated to ending the unnecessary suffering of oppressed and exploited sentient beings and to the total liberation of human animals, non-human animals, and the earth. Now, what greater objective than that to be spending a lot of time working for? Just imagine if millions of us devoted just a small amount of our time to the same thing, not just complaining about it, but doing something about it, because that's where the rubber meets the road. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, it's great to have you on. We haven't talked in a very, very long time, so it's great to be able to do it again for the whole hour.
Yes,
so,
it is.
So much going on. We have four commercial breaks. When you hear the soft music playing, oh, I'll interrupt after a few seconds and we'll take a break and then come back. But, oh, I think you and I pretty much share the same concerns and objectives, and it's appalling to see that we can have a new Congress, we can have a new president, and the beat goes on. The same stuff we rail against. That's the reason I think of Obama as George Bush's third term. I don't see a lot of difference between now and a few months ago, do you?
I don't. No, not at all. I mean, I think initially they try to put on a good face and obviously make it appear that their promises of hope and change were going to be fulfilled, but I don't see that happening. I mean,
I honestly believe, and I suggested this in an article. Oh, I don't have it in front of me, and I forget the date, but it was while the campaign was ongoing, and there was a lot of internal rumblings in the Republican Party, some of the conservatives being very upset at John McCain, and that was one factor, other factors as well. And I kind of suggested, you know, you and I aren't insiders, so we can't know, but I suggested the possibility that what I thought an absurd McCain-Palin ticket was picked to lose, not win, and Obama was picked to win because they wanted a change of pace, a change of face, a guy who's awfully eloquent. Just kind of throw the country off guard and make him think that something really different would happen. And one more thing, Jason, I've said this on the program a couple of times. I live in Chicago, of course, and November 22nd, this place just burst out like New Year's Eve in Times Square. Well, I wasn't out there with it. I thought the whole thing was pretty appalling and sickening that there was a mass celebration by people who literally have no idea what's going on, thinking this guy was about to bring change. I suspected then that there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell that was going to happen. And for the first 3-4 months, that's exactly what's been the case.
No, I agree with you. I mean, you really don't need to look further than the people he's surrounding himself with, starting with this Rahm Emanuel and going on down through the his economic advisors, his Secretary of State. He's shifting the war from Iraq to Afghanistan. Apparently, from what I've been reading here recently, the torture will continue. There's going to be, it's very unlikely that they're going to prosecute any of the former administration for their crimes.
Oh, indeed. We have to take a break, Jason. Let's do it, and then you pick it right up when we get back.
Thank you.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Jason Miller of Thomas Paine's Corner, a guy who does an awful lot of good writing, maintains this website, and has a full-time day job besides, so that really is yeoman service. Jason, you were talking about Afghanistan, and James Petras has a new article that's up on Global Research. I think it went up yesterday. And he does such great work, and he's a regular on this program. He calls it Obama's Animal Farm, Bigger, Bloodier Wars Equal Peace and Justice. Oh, indeed, and he talks about the new commanding general assigned to Afghanistan, this guy, Stanley McChrystal. He calls him a psychopath. Let me read you a line in his article. He calls him a psychopath. He said his rise to leadership is marked by a central role in directing special operations teams engaged in extrajudicial assassinations, systematic torture, bombing of civilian communities, and search and destroy missions. He's a very embodiment of the brutality and gore that accompanies military-driven empire building. So this is the guy that Obama wants to bring a democracy and peace and justice to Afghanistan, plus the thousands more troops that are either there or will be going there. And there's no possibility in the world, Jason, that we can prevail. I mean, the Russians didn't in the 1980s, and the Brits didn't over a century ago. The Afghans will eventually liberate themselves again. And a lot of innocent people are going to die because of this, and Obama is continuing this absolute madness along with Iraq and all the rest. Your comments? Jason? Oh, he got cut off. Well, indeed, it's a very futile effort, and I have to say that without question, the powers that be in Washington know this, but every decision is a political decision. It goes on. Obama, of course, knew what he would do when he took the job. The script was laid out for him. The rules were laid out. His funders made it very clear what they want him to do for them, and we see the trillions of odd dollars given to criminal bankers. We've sure talked enough about it. Jason, are you back on?
I am.
Oh, we got cut off momentarily. Did you hear my comments about General McChrystal?
No, I missed that part.
Oh, the new commander in Afghanistan that James Petras has a new article in Global Research called Obama's Animal Farm, Bigger, Bloodier Wars Equal Peace and Justice. Oh, let me read it again to you. The listeners
sure, I'd like to hear it. I haven't seen that article.
Oh, It's featured on Global Research. You can take a peek at it on the site. It was posted yesterday, I believe. Petras calls McChrystal a psychopath. I mean, that's cutting to the chase.
Right.
And he says his rise to leadership is marked by a central role in directing special operations teams engaged in extrajudicial assassinations, systematic torture, bombing of civilian communities, and search and destroy missions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is the guy that Obama wants to bring peace and democracy to Afghanistan. This is change, Obama style.
Right.
I believe that there are some astute people on our side of the fence, Jason, who believe it's, and I certainly believe this, it's only a matter of time before Obama becomes a hated president, just like George Bush. And I don't like making predictions, and I won't make one now. You could look awful stupid down the road, but I think it's very possible he'll turn out to be a one-term president.
I wouldn't doubt it. And what I think is interesting, though, is that he's already a hated president in some quarters, of course, the far right, the extreme far right, with assassination threats. And the racist elements, the reactionaries, but I think that he's going to alienate his base, so to speak, as well. The centrists and the even the left liberals and some of the people in our quarters that may have been fooled into supporting him, as you indicated, as we've been discussing. I don't see that he's much, if any, of an improvement over Bush.
Well, he sure is not, and it really bothers me. There are some awfully intelligent people who really, oh, maybe on a wing and a prayer, Jason, hope that a guy who presents himself well and speaks well and comes from a somewhat different background and such a change of pace from George Bush really would deliver at least some of the things that he talked about. But I wrote so much about him during the campaign, and then as he was picking his key members of his team, cabinet and some other people, it was very clear. All you had to do, if nothing else, was go back and see the way he voted as a senator. Now, if this didn't tell you what kind of a president he'd be, aside from knowing, Jason, that nobody gets picked for this job, they're all carefully vetted, and
right.
Nobody is picked to be a leading candidate from the two parties unless they're considered safe. So how can anybody with any degree of intelligence ever dream that no matter what they say, no matter what they promise, as soon as they walk into the White House, it's business as usual, nothing will change, nothing substantive will be different, and there may be a few little crumbs around the edges, but it doesn't amount to a hill of beans.
Right, cosmetic changes, and you're right. I mean, the reality is that we live in a plutocracy, and the money people, the money elites, the power elite, as C. Wright Mills coined them, are not going to allow, even if Obama, let's say, for instance, not take a cynical position in looking at him and say that he is sincere in wanting to bring about positive change or change for the better, to bring peace and to improve the plight of the working class and so on and so forth. He couldn't if he wanted to. He's essentially a figurehead. I mean, obviously he has a certain degree of power, but he's fairly limited in what he can do. He's pretty hamstrung by the people around him, the corporate interests that put him in power.
Oh, indeed. And right up at the top of some of his key funders, Jason, were Wall Street firms and corporate lobbyists. Oh, there were a lot of corporate interests that gave him a lot of money, but certainly the Wall Street types and the powerful lobbyists. And they don't make campaign contributions. They make investments.
Right.
And they get very, very big returns on their investments. And they were about the most surefire investments that any of them can make. So they knew what they were getting. And I'm positive that what's played out since he took office back in January, the handout of all these trillions of dollars, that was baked in the cake before he ever walked into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've seen all kinds of numbers that absolutely are beyond comprehension to me.
Right.
I think the numbers, either given or pledged, most of it is pledged so far, runs up to as much as $14 trillion.
I hadn't seen any figures. That's astounding.
It's shocking numbers. I've seen 12.8 trillion on Bloomberg's site. 12.8 trillion, and that goes back a couple of months. So you can't fathom numbers like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the health. It's simple to fix what's going on right now. That's what's so painful to me. And we've discussed it on this program with some wonderful guests who know what they're talking about. Number one, abolish the Federal Reserve. Number one, put these giant banks out of business, break them up.
Mm-hmm.
Make banking a public utility.
Mm-hmm.
Have the government print its own money. And we've had discussions on this program, Jason, that going back to our colonial times for at least a 25-year period, before the Bank of England was created, and then for a time after it came into existence in 1694, all of the colonies printed their own money, and they called it scrip, S-C-R-I-P.
Right.
And for 25 years or more, there were no income taxes, there was no inflation, and there was continued prosperity, not booms and busts.
Right.
Everything was fine. Because we didn't have to pay interest to bankers, and that was the reason we got the federal income tax in 1913, the same year we got the Federal Reserve, because the bankers needed an income stream, so we're it.
We're right.
So
it goes hand in hand with capitalism. I mean, capitalism is cyclical in nature, and it's inevitable that it moves from one crisis to another, and then they patch it back together and as they're doing now, come up with myriad justifications for its continued miserable existence, that it may not be perfect, but it's the best way, and you've got to do essentially extraordinary measures to keep these institutions that are too big to fail from failing, and et cetera, et cetera. And capitalism is what really needs to end. The question, I think, becomes what do we replace it with? And I don't think anyone has come up with a definitive answer on that. But then I was thinking about that this morning, and there really isn't a way to come up with a definitive answer on it because it's all hypothetical. It's never really been tried it's never really been given a fair chance. I mean, if you look at the times that socialism and communism has been, and I'm throwing those out there as alternatives, not the only ones, but those are the socialism and communism being the major or primary alternatives that have been attempted in the Soviet Union, for instance, or in Cuba. But each time they've been attempted, capitalism has sabotaged them in various ways and strangled them in their infancy before they ever had a chance to even begin to flourish. And I'm not necessarily arguing that they would have been successful, but we'll never know if they would have been or not.
Oh, indeed. Jason, we have to take another break. It's amazing. We have a whole hour and the time absolutely evaporates.
Yes.
Oh, it's incredible. We you and I could talk.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Jason Miller, talking about all the big events going on. My goodness, there are so many, Jason. Again, you and I could stay on this and do it the whole day. If we could hold out and Republic suddenly, all of their hosts got sick and they asked us to do a marathon and we were up to it. Heaven forbid. I am not suggesting that. I don't know that my aging body could hold out that long. But it would be an interesting idea to try to go as long as we could and then pass the baton to somebody else to take over. But there are so many issues, so many topics, and we could just go on and on about them. But it really appalls me. I'm very scared about what I see happening. And I think all the time, and I say it, that I wouldn't want to be a young person growing up today, because I just don't know what kind of a future they have to look forward to the way things are going. There's no question that the capitalism that you're talking about is a very, very corrupted system. And here that's set from a product of the Wharton School.
Right.
They taught me the Kool-Aid, but I have to tell you, they lied to me.
Mm-hmm.
They really lied to me. They talked about, the way things work mechanically, but they left out the most important parts, what it does to human beings. And that was back in the 1950s, Jason, before things advanced to such a state as exists today. I wonder what these kids are taught today. I'm sure it's pretty much the same stuff that I was taught.
I would imagine. So it was very much a bourgeois viewpoint of the world. Very, very little criticism of capitalism, if any. Did you read or study any type of Marxism or critiques of capitalism as part of your curriculum? Or?
No, I took some basic courses in college, and more social science, political science. I was never assigned Marx to read. I was assigned a lot of stuff, and I'll never... So much over 4 years going back to the early 1950s, I have to scratch my head and say, now, what did they really assign me? But I do remember the first thing that I read as a high school senior showing up as a freshman at the very beginning, and they gave me some stuff by Hegel to read. Oh, my God. I didn't know what the devil the guy was talking about. And I remember my reaction. I ended up doing okay in that course. It was a couple of science courses I had trouble with as a freshman that maybe decided that science was not the field I should pursue. But right at the get-go, they had me read this Hegel. And I said, oh, my God, if this is what I have to understand to get through and get a college degree, I don't know if I'm going to make it.
It's pretty esoteric stuff. I mean,
it really was, and the language so hard for me to understand. But as it turned out, I had to concentrate most on understanding what the professors were telling me. And if I could feed back the stuff that they gave me, I could do very well for myself. So I picked up on that idea very quickly and gave them back what they wanted and ended up doing very, very well. It was just memorizing those damn chemical formulas that gave me so much trouble. But,
yeah, I'm
but,
sure. I took some chemistry myself, and that wasn't one of my better subjects. There is a lot of memorization. That's pretty difficult.
After my freshman year, it was clear sailing. I struggled a bit with those science courses my freshman year, but it was clear sailing after that. And I must tell you, I had a required natural science course with an absolutely glorious human being, a man named George Wald. And he later won a Nobel Prize in his field, microbiology or biology. But I'll never forget a statement he made in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And the statement, I think I can quote him verbatim to this day. And he said, "There is no such thing as safe nuclear power," unquote. How right he was.
Very true.
Of course, we had dropped a couple of atom bombs, but he was thinking of the commercial side as well.
Right.
And, I've had Howard Zinn on a couple of times, and I think not on the program, but in emails, I mentioned George Wald to him, and he just had the finest things to say about him, both teaching in Boston. George Wald on one side of the river, and Howard Zinn on the other side of the river, and Wald is now gone, and Howard Zinn is, my goodness, he's in his late 80s, 86, 87, whatever it is.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, he's well up in years. Chomsky's in his 80s. The oldest guest I've had on the program, who I'm sure is now 90 years old, last year I had on a man named Doug Dowd. Are you familiar at all with Doug Dowd?
No, I'm not, actually. That name doesn't...
Oh, he's the same, cut out of the same mold as Howard Zinn and others that you and I respect. And he had a new book that he came on talking about. And he was writing another one at age 89, 90, still writing books and still teaching, Jason. Living in Italy and teaching. And the only thing he said was, after he got into his mid-late 80s, he had to slow down a little bit.
Well, I would imagine.
And he had to sit down. He couldn't stand up in front of a class for a whole hour and give a lecture. So, and he didn't like giving lectures. He liked having conversations with his students because he learned from them the way they learned from him.
Right.
What a lovely professor to have.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Oh, we need to take another break. Let's come back and, let me get your thoughts on so much of what's most on your mind. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jason Miller, editor of Thomas Paine's Corner and a glorious activist. Jason, from your recent writing and what's up on the website, what are the things that you're addressing right now that you're most concerned and interested in?
Well, one of the things that you didn't mention at the top of the hour, which is, I understand why, it's a fairly new endeavor for me. I've been at it for about 2 months now, is that I'm now affiliated with the North American Animal Liberation Press Office. I'm a press officer with them, in addition to running my my site or my blog, Thomas Paine's Corner. And what we do is we are the above-ground and legal voice for the underground activists in the animal liberation movement, who obviously cannot speak for themselves or represent themselves in the media, for obvious reasons. So, and actually, let me just read you part of our disclaimer here. It's because the individuals who engage in underground actions cannot reveal their identities to anyone, the North American Animal Liberation Press Office has been created to try to answer some of the questions as to why these actions may have been carried out and to place the actions in a historical and philosophical context. Since we do not engage in illegal activities ourselves, we do not know the details of these actions, but we can try to the best of our ability to give you a better understanding of why a particular action may have been carried out. And by the way, none of us are involved in the Animal Liberation Front, or any of the other, entities, the radical animal liberation groups, such as the Animal Liberation Brigade or the Justice Department. So that's, in a nutshell, that's my primary focus at this point, in addition to, obviously, anti-capitalism. And if you go to my site, I'm still publishing, writing about and publishing articles by other people, more articles by others than myself by far, on other issues, the prison industrial complex, military industrial complex, apply to the Palestinians. I'm still concerned about all of those issues, but I have decided to put most of my focus on the animal liberation movement at this point, because I see that as pivotal, and it's a fundamental area that we need to focus on, animal and earth liberation, because I think we're reaching a tipping point, not only economically. I think that as many people have written and speculated that our economic system is unraveling at the seams, but we're reaching a tipping point ecologically. We're destroying the planet, and we have to change. I don't necessarily think that it's going to be a voluntary change. I don't think that a majority of the human population is going to let go of, for instance, their desire to eat meat or their infatuation with consumerism or materialism. But I don't think there's going to be a choice. Ultimately, if we don't change, Mother Nature is going to force us to change. And I happen to be a part of the movement, the animal liberation movement, that is proactively trying to bring that change about before that happens.
Well, Jason, I support those things as well. For myself, well over 30 years ago, I became a vegetarian. I did it mainly for health, but I also read a couple of books that were just shocking to learn the way factory farms treat animals. Not only the inhumanity of it, but the fact that the animals are crammed together, there can be a plague of toxic pathogens that gets into the food that may not kill people in most cases, but sometimes we may come down with something that we might think is a touch of the flu. It may be, or it may be a light case of food poisoning that we got. Because
right.
We're eating contaminated stuff, and that doesn't even get into the issue of the chemical contamination of everything we eat. Sadly, even organic foods that to some degree can't escape this, because this stuff gets picked up in the atmosphere, in the water, whatever, and it spreads. And then you've got the GMO plague, genetically modified foods. I've had a program on that months back, and I've written a little bit about it. Bill Engdahl has been on the program talking about his book, Seeds of Destruction. These ag giants, four or five of them, that literally want to make all foods, everything, genetically modified. And the evidence is overwhelming that this stuff is slow poison. This stuff kills animals in animal tests. And there's just no question that the ethical scientists realize that what's done to these animals happens to human beings. Just takes longer.
Right.
So we could die of, you name the disease, and it could be, we can't prove it, but it could be because we ate this stuff over years and years and years. And the government goes along with this. It sanctions this stuff to go on because it makes a buck. It doesn't matter how many people suffer and die. It makes
right.
a buck.
You're right. And we in the animal liberation movement, and as a vegan, an ethical vegan, I don't consume any type of animal products, be it eggs, milk, meat, or and I minimize my use of products that are derived from animals, whether it be wearing leather. And I say minimize because it's almost impossible to function in society without using some animal product, because there are just a myriad of products that are out there that have animal products in them, including cars, and it's pretty difficult to function without a car in the system. But we morally believe that human beings do not have the right to exploit animals for the purposes of food consumption or entertainment or scientific testing or any of the many, many ways in which animals are used and abused. And we premise that on the fact that they are sentient, meaning you mentioned that it's in my on the banner of my website or in my mission statement. Sentient meaning they can feel pain, they suffer. But you touched on something very important that will reach far more people than our moral issue, because there are many people who are deeply entrenched speciesists in the sense that, and I was one myself up until a few years ago, in the sense that they accept the cultural tradition that has existed in human society, or essentially throughout history, that animals are ours to use for whatever purpose we desire. But what you were, the issues that you were describing earlier, there's a pragmatic side to this. Moral issues aside, the use and abuse of animals is wreaking havoc on the planet, and it is endangering human beings. You were mentioning the diseases and the chemicals, factory farming, which if most of the population on this planet, most of the human population is going to consume meat, then it will require factory farming to accomplish that goal, which, as you mentioned, is a horrendous existence for the animals. It's a concentration camp-like existence from cradle to grave, and then it's a miserable end to their miserable existence when they're butchered. But it also brings many ills upon the planet in the sense of the vast amounts of water consumption that are required to sustain all those domestic animals that wouldn't even exist if it weren't for the production of meat, and all of the tremendous amounts of waste that those animals, the urine and feces, the output is tremendous. They store them in these huge lagoons which leak into the water supplies, to the groundwater and surrounding rivers, lakes, streams, etc. The rainforest, the rainforests that are devastated or wiped out to create grazing land or agricultural or land to grow crops to feed all these animals. And all of the grain and soy that's diverted from human consumption towards animal consumption. The animals are kept heavily inoculated or vaccinated with all kinds of antibiotics, which renders these antibiotics ineffective because strains of bacteria become immune to them. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
Oh, indeed. I can remember my father-in-law railing about the chickens he didn't want to eat because they were full of antibiotics.
Right.
And he was a conservative old guy. He pretty much went along with an awful lot of stuff that you and I don't. But he railed about this. I don't know where they bought this. They were animal product eaters, But they lived in a small town of Pennsylvania. I don't know where they bought their stuff. Maybe they bought from a local farmer, so they figured the stuff was a lot purer than from a factory farm. One more thing about the production of those foods, Jason, whether we're talking about hogs or beef or whatever, the jobs, working in a slaughterhouse is one of the most dangerous jobs around, extremely dangerous. The workers are poorly treated, they're poorly paid, and the injury rate is extremely high. I mean, you could lose a hand, you could lose an arm. The machines that they use and the knives to do the rendering of the animals. I mean, this stuff, and you're on an assembly line, so this
right.
stuff is moving along, and they're not going to stop it. They want to keep that thing going.
Right.
I mean, they use these people that can get inadvertently carved up like an animal. I mean, they literally can have a very, very serious problem. And when they do, they're just discarded and another worker is brought in to take their place. They don't
You're
care.
Right.
So
You're
companies
right.
like Smithfield Foods, a notorious company, Tyson Foods, these are companies run by people who should be prosecuted for crimes. But of course they're not.
I agree with you 100%. They're criminals, and they're able to get away with it because the unions have been essentially abolished. The meat, what were they called? The meat workers unions, and many of the people that they employ, I think it's over 50% are Hispanic, and many of them are unregistered immigrants. And as you said, they treat them like animals, and if they get injured, which they frequently do, they just discard them. And oftentimes, those people are too afraid to even report a work comp claim.
Oh, indeed. I have to wonder just exactly what kind of worker comp benefits they can even get. I mean, you're talking about workers who are really deeply, deeply exploited, including undocumented workers that these plants love to hire, and
right.
it's done with a wink and a nod. You know, we rail against the quote-unquote illegal immigrants, but we want these people in the country so that these companies like the slaughterhouses can hire them because they have jobs that most people just don't want. They just want nothing to do with these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring them in, or they let them get into small towns in Iowa or North Carolina or whatever. And, it's just absolutely horrendous. You know, you talk about, Jason, the waste that these animals create. Thousands of animals going through it all the time. Well, these animals produce waste just like human beings do, but they don't flush them down the toilet. They flush them into the local river or stream or whatever.
Right.
So massive pollution that takes place. You and I feel the same way. I want no part of supporting an operation like this. I condemn it. I want it stopped. And it's just outrageous any way that you want. Plus, it's harmful to human health.
Mm-hmm.
Swine flu, Jason. I've only mentioned it briefly on the program because I haven't had a program specifically about it. But I wrote an article about real pandemics. You might have spotted it. Not the fake kind. The swine flu business is another fake.
Right.
And they make a big commotion about one person was diagnosed with swine flu, whether or not it's true or not. I mean, somebody may have come down with a bad case of the flu. It could be anything. One person. Well, you want to know about a real pandemic? How about alcoholism? How about deaths from auto accidents? How about people who starve to death? How about people who die from preventive diseases? I mean, you could go on and on down the list of things that are real pandemics that never get a mention in the mainstream news.
That's
never
crazy.
Mention at all.
Right.
We had the avian flu business. Well, there is an association between these illnesses and factory farms because of the pathogens that get into the food supply. Because of the way the animals are processed. Now, whether it's swine or something else, who knows? It's just a whole array of pathogens that gets into the food supply. You can call it anything that you want. But we had an avian flu scare a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I quoted a few organizations, including the World Bank, saying as many as 70 million people could die from it when all was said and done. At the very maximum, and it's a doubtful figure, possibly as many as a few hundred people worldwide died from what you could call the avian flu.
Right.
I don't know how many people have died from what they call the swine flu today, but I don't have any doubt in the world that when all is said and done and this thing dies away, maybe a few people will have died from what somebody calls the swine flu. May not have been swine related, but let's just say it was a few hundred, whatever. As far as people getting sick from the flu, ordinary influenza kills about 30,000 people a year.
Right.
Never a story about it in the mainstream. I mean, it just happens. I mean, thousands die from pneumonia, thousands die from cancer, heart disease. Well, Jason, I think you know, I mean, they're doing this to sell drugs, and they're also doing it to distract people from the real problems going on. So they'll run to the drugstore and buy a dangerous drug. That really is a danger. Nobody should use Tamiflu.
Right.
Nobody should use Tamiflu. It's a dangerous drug. It kills people. It kills people. It's also the company that Donald Rumsfeld is a major shareholder of.
I was actually just going to mention that.
you want to make him richer than he already is? Then go buy Tamiflu.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, but it's a means of social control as well. Putting the fear factor into people, not unlike the war on terror or the war on drugs or any of the other list of wars that we're fighting now.
We're going to take another break, Jason. The rest of the program is all yours.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Final short few minutes. Jason, you have the floor for whatever else is on your mind, and I will say we have to do this again.
Definitely, yes. I'd like to do that.
What else are you thinking about?
I just want to, I guess, to summarize a little bit or maybe elaborate a bit more on what my what our agenda is in the Total Liberation Movement. I'm certainly just one small cog in this machine, if you will. And I do a lot of work with Dr. Steve Best. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's...
No, I'm not.
He's a philosophy professor at the University of Texas, El Paso, who's one of the leading voices of the animal liberation movement, the more radical wing, who philosophically supports militant direct action by groups such as the Animal Liberation Front. And I support those myself as well. But what we're trying to accomplish in moving from animal liberation to total liberation is to unify with other groups, because we have a broader vision than just the animal liberation. We see the ills of capitalism and statism and the military industrial complex and all the forms of hierarchy and oppression that stem from our capitalism and anthropocentrism and Western civilization itself. And so what we want to do, what we're trying to do is reach out and build bridges with other groups, other liberation groups, for example, feminists and indigenous peoples, and essentially radicals of all stripes who see the fundamental need for change, that we as human beings have to change the way that we relate to the world and to nature, to move from instrumentalism, where we use nature, we view nature as ours to do with as we please, as a tool, to forming some kind of an ecological homeostasis where we're in balance with the rest of nature, because we are, after all, despite the fact that we've artificially removed ourselves or partitioned ourselves off from it, we are still a part of nature. But we're not living in sync with it. We're destroying it. And We in the animal liberation movement believe that ending the exploitation of animals is a fundamental component of moving towards that balance with nature and living sustainably, if you will. But what we're doing is obviously not sustainable. Capitalism is a system based on infinite growth, and this planet is obviously finite. So what we're doing is not working.
Jason, it reminds me of the old Pogo line, we've met the enemy and it's us.
Yeah, that's right. It's very true.
I mean, if we don't change us, and your point is so key, we live on a finite planet, and the system, the exploitive system we live under, absolutely demands continued growth. Well, there's a wall out there we'll hit. And we better stop this before we hit it, because by then it's too late.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. That music means we're going to break away to the next program. Oh, Jason, I do want to do this again. It's been a great hour with you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
Oh, we will. I'll get back. We'll do it again. I'm trying to swallow everything at once, like a bountiful buffet. Swallow it all at one time. And I'm only one person, so many hours, but I do the best we can.
Okay.
Oh, I thank you, Jason. Thank listeners. We'll be back tomorrow with another live program.
Great.
Another special guest. Join us then.